just so that we can familiarize the new students with what they can expect from exams and such. The first word of warning you need is that none of the exams this quarter will be multiple choice. Everything is written out, which some students dislike at first because they're used to multiple choice exams, but eventually I think most people end up preferring it because I do, wherever I can, give as much partial credit as I can. And if you got a chance to explain yourself, you might be able to get points where you wouldn't have been able to on a multiple guess exam. Now, if English is not your native language, you are allowed to use electronic translators on your quizzes, exams, lab quizzes. Just needs to be something that is a dedicated translator and not an iPad or something like that where you could have more than the translation functionality. There were three classes, main classes of problems that we had last quarter. One of them was mechanism. So the way that we saw the mechanism for the reactions that we learned today, there will be questions where you do nothing but write out the full mechanism. Another type of question, which is the one that we'll cover first, is what is known as the fill-in-the-blank problem. So you might have a substrate, a reagent that acts on that substrate, and then a product. One of the three of them will be left out, and you have to figure out what goes in the box. Another type of problem is just theoretical, which we'll cover some of those another day. For example, if you were learning about additions to alkenes, you probably heard about this thing called Markovnikov addition. So a type of question I might ask is, what is Markovnikov addition? Why does addition occur that way? What's the underlying reason for that occurring? And in that case, you would describe hyperconjugation being able to stabilize a carbocation in a particular position, and then that's why additions to alkenes occur the way that they do. A fourth type of problem that we didn't get yet, but we're going to get a lot of this quarter, is a multi-step synthesis problem, where you'll be given a particular starting material, you'll be shown a product, but it isn't just one reaction that gets you from the start to the end. It's a sequence of reactions, and part of the problem will be to figure out what is the sequence that would correctly perform that synthesis. So that kind of problem they didn't get yet, maybe you already have where you were before. They'll get it heavily, everybody will get it heavily this quarter. So that'll be the fourth main type. I guess there is one other one that shows up and that's common, and that's nomenclature. So not that I expect that you know every rule there is to nomenclature, but you need to be able to name common types of compounds. So let's start out with the fill in the blank problem, which was the last problem from the final. So first of those, you started out with unknown substrate reacting with mercury acetate in methanol, followed by sodium borohydride and sodium hydroxide. It produced this methyl ether, which we'll be talking much more about ethers this quarter. Now, as a reminder, in situations like this, where you do have a 1 and a 2 listed for your sets of reagents, it does mean that everything listed after the 1 reacts first and then separately from everything listed with the 2 or 3 or so on and so forth. If there weren't 1s and 2s there, it explicitly means all of those reagents are reacting at once. So everywhere where you use reagents, you've got to be careful to use 1s and 2s where you should use them, and not to use 1 and 2s where it's inappropriate. So this two-step reaction is known as what? What does this set of reagents correspond to? Oxymercuration, demercuration, which if you don't know that name, that's one where you make a cyclic mercury intermediate that then gets attacked normally by water, except in this case I've replaced the water with methanol. This is the reason that we end up with a methyl ether as a product and not an alcohol. But otherwise, it's just like oxymercuration, demercuration. What kind of substrate do you have for this kind of reaction? What kind of starting material do you have to have? What functional group? An alkene, or conceivably you could have an alkyne as well. In this case, since we only end up with the ether there, we're going to guess that it's an alkene. And this is a cationic reaction, and so it does occur by Markovnikov addition, which if you forget or don't know what that particular term means, it means that when adding to an alkene, the nucleophile that adds in ends up at the most substituted position. And that's because the electrophile that adds in wants to go to the least substituted position, so it makes the best possible carbocation. So we need an alkene as our starting material with the same number of carbons, and we need it in such a way where the most substituted position is the one where the ether ends up. And so the only possible answer for this reaction is 3-methylbutyenine. Why? Because the secondary carbon is the most substituted, so that's where the methanol is going to end up attacking. If we had the double bond, gotta remember I got this. If we had the double bond here between the tertiary and the secondary carbons, well, that would make the tertiary position the most substituted, and so the ether would end up at that position as well, instead. But that's not what we want. If you remember, this mercury action does have a cyclic intermediate, and because of that cyclic intermediate means it does not have carbocation rearrangement. And so it is perfectly fine having this terminal alkene and expect that we would get the right product. So that is the answer for this particular reaction. Now I'm just going to keep barreling through these, so if you have questions, stop me. And for new people, if you have no idea what kind of reaction I'm talking about, feel free to stop me or make a note that this is something you'll want to go back and review later. For everybody's benefit, sometime during the week I'm going to go back and try to make a list of all the reactions we covered last quarter, so that people who are returning, you can make sure you've got all the flashcards that you should, and those of you who are new, you'll know which things we covered that maybe you already had, which hopefully that'll be a relief, or in case our topics really are out of order, you know which things you might need to go back to study that we've done that you hadn't yet. So questions about this problem? All right, next one. Here are the substrates given, but not the reagents. Product in this case is difunctional, halogen right next to alcohol group. What do we call this kind of functional group, where you have an alcohol and a halogen? A halohydrin. And what are the conditions for synthesizing a halohydrin? But not the conditions, what are the reagents? Ooh, dear. Bromine and water, yes. Without light, this is an electron pair mechanism, not a single electron mechanism. So you would not use light in this case. If you're not familiar with the set of reagents, Br2 by itself makes an alkene into a dihalide, and it forms a cyclic intermediate in the process. If you have water instead of just bromine, water attacks that cyclic intermediate, and it does so at the most substituted position. So that matches what we have with this product here. So halohydrin formed from bromine and water. Next one. An alkene reacting with metachloroperoxybenzoic acid. Those of you who are new, you might have instead learned about magnesium mono... Oh dear, I forget what the... magnesium monoperoxy phthalate, not A, MMPP. The reagent we learned was this metachloroperoxybenzoic acid, which we're going to learn more about benzene-containing compounds this quarter. But peroxybenzoic acid looks just like benzoic acid, except it's got an extra oxygen. The MC, metachloro. Meta is a position two positions away on the benzene ring. So that is metachloroperoxybenzoic acid, which... The students from last quarter were instructed to know these different acronyms for reagents that have been used during the quarter. So MCPBA makes what? epoxides. So an epoxide is a cyclic ether, three-membered ring, two carbons and one oxygen. Because this is a flat alkene, because this is sp2 hybridized, the MCPBA could react on either face of the double bond, which means you are going to generate a set of enantiomers in this case. So the two products would be the following. And they are unique because of that methyl group. They're not symmetric. One we can show with the epoxide ring pointed away from us. The other we could have it showing it pointed towards us. This is a syn addition, meaning it does happen only on one face of the alkene. And that's because for a three-membered ring, it's not physically possible for one part of that ring to be a wedge and pointed up at us, while simultaneously the other side being pointed away from us. Just can't be done geometrically. So those are our two products. Next one. Probably the one that's the most annoying once you see the correct answer. Something reacting with three equivalents of hydrogen and platinum to make this alkane. So hydrogen and platinum, that is hydrogenation. And notice that this is not Lindler's catalyst. This is not a form that has lead carbonate or quinoline or any of those poisoning reagents. So if you had either a double or a triple bond, it would be reduced entirely down to a single bond. And that's kind of what the point of this question is. If you're told that three equivalents of hydrogen are used, that means there's three pi bonds in this molecule. But the tricky bit of this is that you can't have a pi bond that goes to that central carbon. Why? Because there's already four bonds there. So you can't make a double bond that goes to the center. So the only places for a double bond are on the left two carbons or the right two carbons. But somehow we have to fit 3 degrees of unsaturation there. Well, that means the answer is to put a triple bond on one side and a double bond on the other. So the triple bond uses up 2 equivalents of hydrogen. The double bond uses up only 1. Put them together, that's your 3 hydrogens, your 3 degrees of unsaturation. And again, the middle one can't have a double bond because it already has 4 bonds. Next problem, starting with an alkyne and reacting with something to make an alkene. So alkyne to alkene, that is partial hydrogenation, which can be accomplished using Lindler's catalyst. So for our class last quarter, they did not have to know the constituents of Lindler's, but if you're not familiar with Lindler's, it's a variation of a platinum or palladium reagent, which you do have some kind of poisoning or deactivating agent, usually some form of lead, like lead carbonate, usually some other bases that are thrown in, like quinoline, a compound that we'll learn about later this quarter. For our class, it's good enough just to know that it's Lindler's. But Lindler's itself is not the full reagent, that's just the catalyst. You need something to react with it. Well, so since we ended up putting deuterium on here, that means D2 is the reagent that goes with it. And you had to specify both of those for it to get full credit. Next problem. Probably the sneakiest. It is something we discussed when we talked about hydration of alkynes. Because if you take an alkyne, for example, and try to react it with borane, it won't make this kind of product. Because what kind of functional group is that starting material that I've shown you? what's the name of that type of molecule that has both an alkene and an alcohol? Mainly when it's used, that term, it's talking about something where it's at the same carbon. Well, if you have an alkene and you have an alcohol, these are called enols. That's right. And enols are thermodynamically unstable. So, in fact, when we see a mechanism for one of the problems in just a bit, we're going to review tautomerization, which is the interconversion of a single and a double bond, but not through just resonance. It's an actual reaction. So enols tautomerize, and in this case, since we have a secondary carbon effectively where that enol is, we're going to end up with a ketone. Now, if you haven't seen this type of thing before, let me write down that process so you could look it up. That's tautomerization. Now, questions before I move to a new page? All right. Then the last of the fill-in-the-blank problems was one that the class had been warned about. The one multi-step reaction you did need to know last quarter. So something reacting with two sets of reagents to convert an alkene into an alkyne. This is the two-step process of first making a vicinal dihalide by reacting with just plain bromine, no light. That'll put one bromine, one carbon, one bromine at the other carbon. And then doing a double elimination using two equivalents of some strong base like sodium amide. Now, if you did not put 2EQ in, I think I still gave you full credit, but just realize technically you do need two separate molecules of the base, so you could do two different eliminations to get you to the alkyne. So now let's step back one problem and go over the mechanisms. So we had three different mechanisms you had to do. First one was a reaction with an alkyne. So an alkyne first reacting with that strong base of sodium amide, followed by a reaction with iodomethane. And then finally, sodium in ammonia. So first step of the reaction is related to the acidity of alkynes. So we talked last quarter about three main structural effects that can affect the acidity of a compound. One of them is hybridization, which I'll revisit in just a moment because it applies to this compound. Another one of those factors was inductive effects. If you have a very electronegative element that can pull electrons towards it, it makes a bond with whatever was there easier to break. And then resonance. Things like acetic acid are acidic as they are because the ions they form once they lose a hydrogen are stabilized by resonance. So in this case, what happens is if that hydrogen were to come off and leave its lone pair behind, that lone pair would reside in an sp hybridized orbital. Well, an sp orbital in a polyelectronic system like this ends up being lower in energy than sp2, which is lower in energy than sp3. So putting a pair of electrons into an sp orbital is energetically more favorable than putting it into an sp2, than putting it into an sp3. That means it's easier for the hydrogen to come off because the anion is easier to form for something that's sp versus sp2 versus sp3. So alkynes are much more acidic with a pKa of about 25 than alkenes, which have a pKa of about 34, than alkanes, which have a pKa up in the 50s or 60s range. So first step of the reaction is that strong base, sodium amide, deprotonates the alkyne. And makes a type of ion known as an acetylide ion, which we will see acetylide ions again later this quarter when we cover a reaction known as the Grignard reaction, one of the most important reactions we do this quarter. This acetylide ion is very basic, but it's also nucleophilic. And in fact, it's a perfectly fine nucleophile as long as you have a primary substrate that you react with. Secondaries or tertiaries, you'd have elimination. Well, we have methyl iodide that's not even a primary, it's just a methyl substrate. One of the best targets for an SN2 reaction you possibly could have, because it's got essentially no steric hindrance. So very rapid SN2 reaction would then occur between the acetylide and the iodomethane. New students, I'm fussy about lone pairs. So some textbooks don't even bother writing pairs of electrons in. I do because I want to make sure you know what oxidation state things are. So if you're not in the habit of writing lone pairs, well, you're going to need to have a crash course in them. So the result here is adding another carbon to that alkyne. So we've converted now from propyne to butyne. We still have one more step of the reaction, which is sodium and ammonium. That you need to recognize as the conditions for reduction to form a trans alkene. So this is one of only two radical reactions we properly covered last quarter. One of them is this one, this reduction. The other one is free radical halogenation. So the reason I'm pointing this out is because much of this part of the mechanism occurs using the single-headed arrows, where only one electron at a time is moving around, unlike these double-headed arrows that you've seen both in lecture today and just now, where two electrons are involved. First step of the reaction is for the triple bond to be broken up by the addition of an electron. The electron is essentially just floating around in solution, and it comes from the sodium metal. Sodium is a good reducing agent because it has a low ionization energy. So an electron adds into the triple bond, which a bit of review of molecular orbital theory, which we will have much more molecular orbital theory this quarter, which means, yes, there'll be more SMOG diagrams this quarter. So in this alkyne, the three bonding orbitals between the two carbons are filled. That's how we get a triple bond. The only place then the electron can go is into an antibond, which is why one of the three bonds then breaks. You end up with an intermediate known as a radical anion. And it doesn't actually matter which side you write the anion and which side you write the radical, because both sides eventually are going to react. That product that we just made is much more basic than the acetylide ion was, because we have an sp2 hybridized carbon now instead of sp3. Which it's basic enough to be able to deprotonate ammonia. Ammonia itself is a base, but it becomes an acid in this situation. And since this is a regular acid-base reaction, we're back to the double-headed arrows. We still have electrons floating around in solution, and so the next step is for an electron from solution to add in to the radical that's present. This is the key part of the reaction, because when it was just a radical, that carbon was sp hybridized. Remember that single electrons do not have the repulsive force of pairs of electrons, so they don't affect geometry, so they're not encountered in Vesper theory. And because hybridization is done to match geometry, because that single electron doesn't count towards the geometry, it also does not count towards hybridization. So only one bond on either side of that carbon. That's why it's sp hybridized. As soon as it gains that electron, it becomes sp2 hybridized, which is why the methyl group that's at that position now ends up being trans to the original methyl group, because that's thermodynamically more favored. It avoids steric hindrance between the two methyl groups. We still have ammonia around, which will provide another hydrogen. So that our final product is trans-butene. Questions on the mechanism? All right, moving to the next one. Much simpler reaction. An alkene reacting first with HBr, and then second, sodium methoxide. So the first reaction, plain old simple electrophilic addition. Double bond attacks H plus first. This is Markovnikov addition, because we end up with the hydrogen, the electrophile, at the less substituted position, forming the more substituted carbocation, which, since there's bromide still floating around in solution, it attacks next to make only one product. Realize that since the ring is symmetric, there is no stereocenter there. But I am going to write it with wedges and dashes because of the next step that I want to show properly. So I don't remember now exactly how I graded it. I think if you showed me two different products but were really the same one, I just ignored it. But realize there is no stereocenter there. So there is only one product made at this point. Now, the reason I'm showing this is because of the sodium methoxide. So what kind of alkyl halide is this that I just produced? Is it primary, secondary, or tertiary? Oh, dear. What do primary, secondary, and tertiary mean? Means how many carbons are connected to that same position. If you look where the bromine is attached, there's the two directions of the ring and then the methyl group. So that means it is a tertiary alkyl halide. In terms of SN1, SN2, E1, E2, which reactions can tertiary substrates not do? A tertiary substrate cannot do SN2. It can do SN1 or E2 and E1. But in order to do substitution, we need a non-basic weak nucleophile. What kind of nucleophile do we have here? It's a strong one. Why? Because it's anionic, and it's anionic on oxygen. Because it's oxygen, that means it's also basic. So which type of reaction is going to happen? E2, because since it's a base, it won't wait around for a carbocation, so that's why SN1 won't happen. And for some similar reasons, and since SN1 and E1 have the same intermediates, E1 won't happen. Now, since this is E2, because we have a basic nucleophile and a tertiary substrate, what about regiochemistry? Is this base hindered or small? Is this as hindered as T-butoxide, for example? No. So for regiochemistry, remember, it is possible to have what's called Hoffman or anti-Zaitsev elimination if you have a really hindered base. But we don't have a really hindered base. So that means that the more substituted alkene is going to be the one that's preferred, which means the hydrogen I wrote in on the ring there is the one that's going to get removed. So this is an E2 mechanism. Notice the stereochemistry of that hydrogen. It must be pointed the opposite way of bromine, because only if the hydrogen and the leaving group are anti-periplanar to each other is elimination possible from a cyclohexane ring. In other words, they both have to be able to be axial instead of equatorial. None of that, of course, necessarily appears in the mechanism. I'm just describing that reaction for review. In terms of mechanism, methoxide pulls off hydrogen. The electron from the hydrogen collapses to kick bromine off. And so the one and only product that we get from the reaction is this. So it's really a two-step process to move the double bond. Shall we do the last mechanism? Which you all that were with me last quarter should have expected, because I made a big deal at the time that we did the third test that we had not seen the borane mechanism. And so that's exactly what this problem is. Hydroboration oxidation. We flip to a clean page because this is a more interesting one that involves an alkyne. And because it's an hydroboration oxidation of an alkyne, it uses that special hindered reagent. So new students, this was not even in the textbook for some reason, but this is a reagent that I expect everyone still to know. So if you're familiar with BH3, with borane, this has the same reactivity, except for two major differences. One, there's only one hydrogen on the boron, so only one hydrogen per boron will react. That reduces the formation of boron networks, a byproduct that can interfere with the reaction with alkynes. It's also got all this steric hindrance caused by the two alkyl groups on there, which again will help prevent the formation of a network product. After the reaction with that, it has the same workup conditions of hydrogen peroxide and sodium hydroxide. This alkylating reagent, you can abbreviate R2BH, because the alkyl group we don't actually care about. Some of you wrote the mechanism focusing on that alkyl group, but it's just there to control the reactivity of borane. The alkyne is the main target, and so you had to show what happened to it. So, hydrogen is more electronegative than boron, so it's going to be hydrogen that ends up on the less... No, wait, I just said that backwards. Boron that's going to end up at the less substituted side, and hydrogen that ends up on the more substituted side. So I'm going to write out my mechanism like this, putting boron closer to where it is going to end up. To make it simpler to write, I am going to use R notation everywhere. Reduce how many things we're drawing. So first step of the reaction is a concerted mechanism. Four-centered transition state, where the alkene attacks the boron at the same time, hydride slips onto the alkyne. Technically, that would... Oh, no, it wouldn't. Never mind. You'll get a syn addition to that double bond because the four-centered transition state can only happen with syn geometry. And really, you only need to show this part of the mechanism once, because borane, this version of borane, only had one hydrogen on it. So that's partly why I chose this reagent. It is actually a shorter mechanism. So the thing that happens next is the hydrogen peroxide and hydroxide oxidize this compound. Hydrogen peroxide and hydroxide in solution will form the hydrogen peroxide ion. Which can attack boron because boron does not have a complete octet. That will make boron negatively charged. And then it is this point where probably the strangest part of the reaction occurs. Because currently there is a sequence of carbon, boron, oxygen, oxygen bonds. Well, a carbon-boron bond is not as good as an oxygen-boron bond. And an oxygen-oxygen bond is weaker than that even, and definitely worse than a carbon-oxygen bond. So what occurs is an alkyl shift. And it's rare because it does end up making hydroxide effectively like a leaving group. But it happens because overall this is a thermodynamically favored process. And it's largely due to the fact that that oxygen-oxygen bond is relatively weak. So that shift occurs. Now, putting the oxygen between the carbon and the boron. And at this point, the decomposition occurs. Hydroxide attacks boron, which again makes a negatively charged boron. Which can relieve that negative charge if an oxygen turns right back around and disconnects. The hydroxide itself could be the thing that comes back off, but sometimes this target alkyl group could be the thing that comes off, which if it does, it can stop reacting because it can have a neutralization occur. And many of you got to this point in the mechanism. Problem is, that's not the right answer. Because it's an enol. And enols are thermodynamically unfavorable. So the last part of this mechanism, and why it was a separate problem, is tautomerization. So hydroxide can pull a hydrogen back off of this molecule. Then this is a delocalized ion. So we could write a resonance structure where we push the negative charge to carbon instead. Which once we're at that point, water that would be floating around in solution because we had hydroxide could be the source of a hydrogen for that molecule to get protonated. And we end up with an aldehyde. Recognize we cannot use H+. It has to be water, because if you got basic conditions, there are no H+s around. Questions on this last mechanism? Then we only have time to do one more problem for today, and I want to back up one more problem, because that involved pairs of SN2 reactions, SN1 and SN2 reactions. You are asked to determine which of the pair of reactions is faster. So let's tackle those now. So first pair of reactions, we have the same substrate and same nucleophile. So bromoethane reacting with sodium fluoride to make fluoroethane. So again, both of them had the same reagent, same substrate. But in one case, the reaction's conducted with methanol. In the other case, reaction's conducted in this molecule, which you had to recognize that as DMF. F, N,N-dimethylformamide. Very common lab solvent, very common SN2 solvent. Why? Because good SN2 solvents are polar aprotic solvents. Well, methanol is extremely protic. It's like water. DMF is aprotic. It does not have an easily reactable hydrogen. So DMF will not interfere with fluoride as much as methanol will. And so that second reaction is the faster one. Because it has an aprotic solvent. The next pair this time we had the same reagent but two different substrates. So fluoroethanol reacting with sodium hydroxide to make fluoroethane reacting with sodium hydroxide to make ethanol, or bromoethane reacting with sodium hydroxide to make ethanol. Now I'll point everyone's attention to one of the directions in the problem, which says, be sure to explain the underlying reason for the greater reaction rate. An answer in the form of the molecule has a better whatever is incomplete or inadequate. So many of you, if you looked at this and said, oh, well, bromine's a better leaving group, you're right. Why? That's what the question was asking. Give the underlying reason. The underlying reason is bromide is the conjugate base of a strong acid, which means bromine itself is not basic. Fluoride is the conjugate base of a weak acid, which means fluoride is basic, which is why it's a poor leaving group. So it is true that the second reaction is faster, and it is true because bromine is a better leaving group, but you need to say it's a better leaving group since it is the conjugate base of a stronger acid. It's from HBr, which is strong, versus HF, which is weak. Next one, same type of reaction, but two different substrates. In both cases, they involve an ionic nucleophile that has sulfur as the main attacking atom. Is this a strong nucleophile or a weak nucleophile being used? Strong, and in fact, even though SH minus is not as basic as hydroxide, it's far more nucleophilic due to the fact that sulfur is big and squishy. In other words, it is polarizable, so it begins the process of bond formation more easily than oxygen. So, strong nucleophile favors which type of reaction, SN2 or SN1? SN2. SN2 reaction favors what kind of substrate, primary or tertiary? Why? Less steric hindrance. So the faster reaction is going to be the first one. It's SN2, and there's less steric hindrance. The last one, similar situation. Two substrates, same reagent. So bromoethane making ethanol versus 2-bromo-2-methylpropane reacting to make T-butanol. We have water. Is that a strong or weak nucleophile? Weak because it's neutral, it's non-ionic. So weak nucleophile favors SN1 or SN2? SN1. Primary or tertiary substrate favors SN1. Why tertiary? It makes the more stable carbocation. You almost can't make a primary carbocation. So it's S and 1 in this case. And it makes a more stable intermediate. What I'd like to do now is pause for about 5 minutes. Usually in lab, we'll have, on paper, it's supposed to be 50 minutes of lab lecture. And then even though it doesn't say so, we're supposed to give a 5-minute break between that and then the rest of the lab. And so just to make sure we're matching that, we'll take our short break. Please don't go run off to Coffee Society or something like that, because we'll just have a brief reintroduction to lab safety in the pre-lab, and then we'll jump straight into checking in and be done and be gone. Let us go through our somewhat reduced safety lecture. So I just want to go over the main things that we have to absolutely make sure that we do know. First one is exits out of the room. So if there is an earthquake or some other kind of emergency, how can you get out of here? The two absolutely best doors to take are the two that do have the exit signs on them, so the two glass doors here. Although, if you've never been in an earthquake, realize those are glass doors, so you don't actually want to run to them while the earthquake's happening, just in case, I mean, even though they might be safety glass, in case they fail, you don't want shards of glass coming at you. If you go out this one to my left, that's probably the best of the two doors because there's a staircase that's tucked away in the back side of the building here, and probably only the lab next door here would be trying to get down that staircase. The door over here right behind us or directly in front of me, that one goes to the big ugly staircase that's over there, but that's the one everybody's going to be taking if they're panicking. So I would recommend going out this side one. The two wooden doors to my left and right, those are not direct exits. They do connect to a room that does then have a door, but only into the interior again, not to the exterior of the building. So those are the ones you take last, mainly because they have locks on them and you can't get through them without my key dongle anyways. The only other one that's a viable exit is the door that you can come through from the hallway there, which if you go through that door and go straight on through, there is an exit out of the building that goes to that same staircase that's back behind the building here. But in other words, best exit is the one to my left. You'll notice that there's a fire alarm at that door. There is also another fire alarm at the other exit door. In terms of safety, we have 6 eyewash stations. There's the 2 in the back of the classroom, the 2 in the front of the classroom, and then the 1 in the back door, the 1 in the front door. We have 2 safety showers as well, which makes me think that you remind me to tell you that you might want to have an extra set of clothes with you for lab. Just in case you have something happen where you get chemicals all over you and you need to not be in those clothes. Particularly as the weather gets better and warms up again. It was kind of a chilly day out this morning. People do tend to have the preference to wear shorts. You can't wear shorts in lab, though, and so that's why I'm recommending that you have an extra set of clothes, because often what people do is they'll have a pair of sweatpants, track pants, something like that, that they can change into just for lab. But let me just turn that around and say again, though, you can't wear shorts. Whatever you have does have to come down to the ankles, so whether it's jeans, slacks, dress, whatever, needs to be full length. And then goggles. I'll probably mention goggles a couple more times. But how many of you remember to bring your goggles for today? Because realize it's not just chemicals we're worried about, it's even more so glassware, shards of glass flying around. So if you didn't bring your goggles with you today, we do have a box up here where you can borrow some until you get a chance to get your own pair. When I say borrow, you can use them while you're here in the lab, but you need to return them. They're supposed to be a common set. Back to some of the other safety considerations. In the stockroom, we do have a small first aid kit, so if you have minor cuts or whatever, you can probably get help there. We do have a medical center or a small center here on campus if you are somewhat more seriously injured, or depending on what happens to you, we might directly dial 911, which just to point out, we do have a phone here in the classroom where you can dial 911 directly. You don't need to dial 9 to get out. You'll notice in front of all the sinks, we have these notices that nothing gets disposed of down the sink. There's an exception to that, which if you're cleaning out glassware, after you've washed it out the first time, that first wash does need to go into regular waste, which will be located in fume hood H5. You'll notice all the fume hoods are numbered, and H5 is where waste for this class is stored. However, once you have washed a piece of glassware out once, then any other washes that you might do, as long as there's no visual contamination, then the rest of the washes can go down the sink. So that's the one exception to the nothing goes down the sink rule. There will be different waste bottles that are back in that H5 fume hood. On an experiment-by-experiment basis, I'll explain which waste bottle to use for which kinds of compounds. The chemicals will be set out and provided in this fume hood H13. So after I'm done, we do check-in. I'm going to ask you to select a fume hood to use for the quarter. H13 don't use because that's where chemicals will be put out. H5 don't use because that's where the waste bottles will be. There are some pet peeves that I have regarding lab cleanliness and chemicals, but I'll go over those on Wednesday when we're going over the pre-lab for our first experiment. So I think I've gotten all the major safety protocols. Please, once the syllabus is posted, do read through the other safety guidelines that are in the syllabus. Now let's see, what else have we got? I guess I should probably tell you what the first experiment is. So, new students, if you have not purchased the lab book, which I just had it this morning, it must be in my office. Does anybody have their lab book with them? I was just going to show you the cover of the lab. You've got the electronic one. So, it is the most recent version of the lab text. It is very similar to a previous edition. So if you have a previous edition, you might be able to use it. But just if you're trying to manage like that, check with someone that does have a real copy of the lab text before doing your pre-lab, which it's the reason I was looking for the text is so I could discuss pre-lab. But I do have the page numbers written down here if you give me just a moment. So the first experiment is the oxidation of cyclododecanol. There's a theory portion of it and an experimental portion of it. So the reason I make that distinction in the syllabus is that the theory portion you don't have to do anything with as far as your pre-lab preparation. Now the mistake that students make every quarter is because I don't check for theory in pre-lab, no one reads it, no one does anything with it, and then about the time that the lab quiz comes along, all of a sudden, everybody gets panicked about it. But because most people wait until the lab quiz to start studying that information, it doesn't stick as well. And so people do poorly compared to the way they should be able to perform on the lab quizzes. Because the lab quizzes, to be honest, are not that difficult as long as you had been studying the theory all the way along. Now, one other major component besides the theory portions that are going to be assigned for each experiment, one other thing that's going to be on the lab quiz is NMR. So new people, if you've not done NMR theory before, last quarter we got through the theory, but we did not get into taking spectra and figuring out structures from that. That's what we're going to be doing heavily this quarter. So if you haven't had NMR theory at all, you probably don't have time to go back and listen to all the recordings from last quarter, but at least download the written notes from last quarter so you can figure out what we had discussed in terms of NMR. Because we did talk about the essential construction of an NMR machine, what Fourier transfer NMR is. We talked about chemical shift, talked about splitting, talked about integration. So we talked about all the pieces of analyzing a spectrum, but we just haven't put it all together and done spectral analysis yet. So now the page numbers for that first experiment. The theory is on 537 through 542. And then the procedure is page 543 through page 547. Most of the experiments in the text have two different versions. There's a mini scale and a micro scale. We, by default, will always do the mini scale. So just skip the micro scale entirely. And for this first experiment, we'll do the quantities as stated in the text. So we're going to do the experiment as written, but just for the micro scale portion of the experiment. Now, since we potentially have everybody here that's going to be here for this quarter, let me make this announcement that this pre-lab, and I'll tell you more about why we're doing a pre-lab and what we do for the pre-lab in just a second. But this pre-lab is always due the first day we begin a new experiment. So we're going to start our first experiment on Wednesday. So this pre-lab that I'm about to describe will be due on Wednesday. According to the schedule as listed in the syllabus, when you have the first day of a new experiment, even if I forget to remind you about the pre-lab will always be due. Even if the lab schedule changes in real life because maybe I'm absent one day or something like that, the pre-labs will still be due on the day as listed in the syllabus. So that will not change during the entire quarter. So maybe sometimes I won't check pre-labs. Maybe sometimes I will. But whether or not I check it or not, and whether or not I mention to do it or not, don't show up and tell me, oh, I didn't know I had to have my pre-lab done. Because all of you were here. It looks like all of you are mostly awake. And so you all just heard that announcement that a pre-lab is due no matter what. Now, why is it that I make you do these pre-labs? To give you the quick rundown. Reason number one is safety. Because there'll sometimes be reagents that are hazardous. This is not Chem 1. And so particularly towards the middle of the quarter and some of the reagents we use next quarter, much more hazardous than things we used in Chem 1A. And so I want to make sure you've read that pre-lab, so if there's big warning notes about what to do with those reagents, you've seen them. There was a case last quarter where we had a big note like that, that the people that did the pre-lab were aware of it, and the people that didn't do the pre-lab weren't, and could have very likely subjected themselves to exposure of chemicals that they should not have. Of course, I then yelled at everybody about not doing pre-labs, so everybody knew about it. The point is, you need to realize that as an adult, you got to take care of your own safety, and don't depend on me to make you safe. You should think, I'm in a lab, and I don't know what these chemicals are. Do I need to worry? And that's partly why you're reading the pre-lab, to find out if you need to worry or not. Aside from safety of yourself, there's safety of other people around you. So even if you don't care enough about your own self, don't take someone else out just because you're not being careful about your own self. Safety is an issue. Time's an issue. If you've already read the pre-lab and you know what to do, and you're just waiting for me to stop talking so you can do your lab, well, if you're that kind of organized person that gets done an hour before everybody else, then you get to go to lunch or whatever an hour before everybody else. Because once you're done with lab, you get to leave. You don't have to wait till 2:10 to come around. Which, if you are watching the clock, that is still an hour fast. So we actually have an hour and change left, not just 15 minutes left. Now, if you don't care about time efficiency, then you all have probably had a class before where you had someone in lab that goes around asking, wait, what's that first step? Wait, what's step two? Is it 5 milliliters or 10? Is that blue? What goes in this one? You know, being annoying in lab, which means you're being unsafe because you don't know what's going on. But don't be the pest. Don't be the person that's leeching off of someone else. And above everything else, you're supposed to be learning something from lab. So if you don't even know what lab you're doing, how are you going to learn much from it? So read the theory. Read the theory. Don't wait till lab quiz day to read it. Do the pre-lab for the procedure, because here's all you have to do to complete a pre-lab. In fact, when you download that syllabus later, ignore what the syllabus says about pre-lab for now. Ignore what it says about lab reports for now, because lab reports are going to be heavily simplified compared to what the syllabus says. That syllabus is kind of catch-all for all courses I teach, and Chem 1, that's quantitative analysis, much more extensive lab reports. Ours are going to be one-pagers. So maybe look over it, but kind of ignore a lot of it. Ignore a lot of what it says about lab notebooks, although now that I'm thinking of lab notebooks, does anybody have theirs from last quarter I can hold
people, this is all you have to have for a lab notebook. Something where it's not spiral bound. Don't accept spiral bound notebooks, and you can't have perforated pages. But otherwise, plain $2-3 Target special for a lab composition book is perfectly fine. And whether it's plain pages, line, graph, log graph, doesn't matter, as long as it's not perforated and it's not spiral bound. If you have a lab book from a previous quarter, all of you who had me last quarter, if you would just clip or clamp or staple the 10, 12A pages so that I can easily just skip to the 12B, feel free to reuse your lab books. But even though I'm saying ignore the syllabus as far as lab books, the two things I'll tell you you need to do, do leave a page for table of contents if you don't do anything else at first. And put your name and some other identifying piece of information in there. Because somebody in here is going to lose their lab book during the quarter. It happens every single quarter. Now, you might not want to put your phone number or address because of identity theft concerns, but at least maybe put my name, which quarter you're taking it, and your name, so that maybe it'll end up back in the stock room if nothing else. So, the other thing, the table of contents. Leave room for a table of contents. Anything else the syllabus describes, I'll describe a little bit more as we get going for the quarters. Now, what you need to do for the pre-lab, pretty simple. This is based on the idea that if you're a true researcher, you don't have a cookbook that you can go to where a procedure is necessarily written out for you. So a researcher might do an experiment based off the procedure, but they'll write the experiment up for their own particular application ahead of time. And then you don't bring in your supporting text, you just have your lab notebook that's sitting there that you follow to perform your experiment. And that's the idea behind what we're going to do here. I recommend that you have a two-column format, where in one of those columns, you list your procedure steps like a grocery list, a checklist of things that you need to do. Only put in as much detail as you need to be able to perform the experiment. So if the book takes a paragraph to describe what you only need a sentence to describe, fine, put that one sentence in. How will you know if you've got enough detail in there? Well, if you can close the book and perform the experiment and not need to look at your text even once. That's the expectation. In fact, that's the way we're going to do this first experiment. During the pre-lab discussion, where I talk about mechanism, safety, and how to do the experiment, you can have your lab text open. But once it actually comes time to perform the experiment, can't have your textbook out. Now, for a simple experiment, this might only take up one page. Maybe it'll only take you 20 minutes to write. That's fine. Maybe a more complicated experiment, it might take you an hour to get through this. That's fine, because at least you're then familiar with the experiment. But the theory part you don't have to include here. That's why it's sadly ignored a lot of the time. And again, make sure you have just enough detail, but enough detail, that you could follow this procedure and perform the experiment without looking at your main lab text. The second column here, you could assign for data or observations. You're not going to have nearly the amount of data that you would have in a Chem 1 experiment, or if you did, it's going to be in the form of spectra, which will be separate anyways. But this you need to have prepared when you walk in the door on Wednesday. So new people, questions about what to do for pre-lab? Pretty straightforward. Just read the procedure and in your own words, write the procedure out. Now, let's see. I gave you the page numbers. Oh, yes. Most of the experiments you're going to be doing individually. So you're going to share a fume-hood space. One person works in one half, one person works in the other, but each person does their own experiment. Yes? Okay, so the question is basically, do you have to be able to write out exactly what to do, supposing that you don't understand what a reaction step or procedure step is? If you find something you don't understand, then copy word for word, and then that's what you have the pre-lab lecture for, the chance to ask how to do a particular step. If you understand what's going on, you could either copy it word for word or just write it in your own words.
I won't go as far to say write it however you want to, because I only speak a limited number of languages, and so don't write it in your native language, for example, but write it in your own phrase. Unless you don't understand something, then copy it and just start to remind you to ask about it during lab lecture. All right, so we have the crash safety. I told you what the first experiment is, talked about pre-labs, labs, everything else can wait till we actually start a lab. And so we're going to do the check-in now. So let me describe the check-in procedure before we begin. This is the one time in the quarter that you get to check over your lab equipment, and if you're missing something or if it's broken, you get to replace it for free. After today, even if you come back later and say, oh, yeah, I forgot to check that item. Well, that's too bad, isn't it? Because this is the one day, like I said, that you get to replace something for free. I don't actually check the glassware today. It's up to you to do it. So you want to be really careful to make sure there's nothing missing or broken. When you get the check-in sheets, there'll be two tables. One table, the top one, corresponds to larger items that are going to be found in a white basket that's in your drawer. The rest of the items on the lower table are in a yellow toolbox. I will put each item individually on this overhead, and so we can do a group check-in, because even returning students often forget the names of the items that are in that toolkit. So we're going to do this as a group check-in. Takes a lot less time. If you find anything that has chemicals in it that didn't get cleaned out from last quarter, leave it. Don't spend an hour cleaning the day. You can start doing that on Wednesday if you wanted to. If you have anything that's missing, the stock room, which is back out here, will provide it to you again for free today. If you have something that's broken, we have a broken glass trash can. It's the big round one over on this side of the classroom. Please do not use regular trash cans for broken glass. Check very carefully any rounded pieces of glassware that you have. You might end up with what's known as a star crack. It looks like a little asterisk, and it can happen when a rounded piece of glass smashes into something that's flat. So do check your round pieces of glassware for star cracks. Your graduated cylinders, take the plastic base off the cylinder, check the bottom of it. Because we used to do an experiment in the distant past where we have little weights or objects that were dropped into a graduated cylinder, and if you didn't do it right, well, you could crack the bottom and not know it until you put liquid into that graduated cylinder. Go over all the items in your list today. Anything that's missing, replace it. Once you're sure you've got everything, you'll bring the list up to me and I'll sign it. I'm going to give you a pink copy that you keep to prove that you checked in, and then the original white copy I give to the stockroom so that they can use that as a record. During the quarter, if you need to check items out, there are these little yellow pieces of paper that we use where you fill out your name, the date, the thing you need to check out, and you give that to the stockroom. That you don't need to do today because we're doing check-in. But just to make sure for the new people that you know about that, you give them the yellow slip, they give you the piece of equipment. When you're done with it, you give them a piece of equipment back and make sure that they give you that yellow slip. Because any yellow slips at the end of the quarter they still have, then they're going to think you still have those items and they'll charge you for it. At the end of the quarter, whether you drop the course or make it all the way through the course, at some point you got to check out of lab. If you don't check out of lab, you can be assessed a fee for not doing the checkout. They can put a hold on your grades, and any of the missing glassware they'll charge you for as well. Often what happens when we do the group checkout at the end, some people end up with extra glassware that ends up magically in the hands of the people that have missing glassware. Well, you miss out on that opportunity if you don't come for the checkout. So once you check in, at some point, you got to check back out. So if you don't have your goggles, come up and get some of these common goggles, because you have to have goggles because we're worried about glassware for today. The handful of you that's been drinking water during lab, realize that this is not a lecture space, and so even bottled water is not allowed in here. That's not because I think magically the water is going to get contaminated sitting in the lab. It's because you, with your hands, are going to touch that bottle, and those hands have touched surfaces that have chemicals on them. So food, drink, cosmetics should not be brought out at all and used in here. For those of you, let's see, this is the afternoon section, so I don't think I saw any coffee cups come in like I did this morning. But those should be just left outside here. Any food or drink that you do have in here, I'll either ask you to throw away or leave it outside, or if it's chocolate, I'll just take it. So, but there is a common area that people have been leaving items, which it appears that that system's been working. People haven't had things disappear because what one person does for their own self, they hope that someone else would respect and do the same. But just no more food and drink in the lab after today. I'm going to give you your locker numbers. I can't, the different sets are assigned to us, so I can't just randomly give you any number. And in fact, the numbers I'm going to give are in alphabetical order because it makes it easier for the stockroom. Check your items. Once you've checked all your items, then I sign your sheet. Once I've signed your sheet, you're done for today. So any questions before we do begin the check-in process?